Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
In addition to being an amazing angler, George Daniel is a fishing educator and a family man. Hailing from Pennsylvania, George learned from years of experience from his mentor, Joe Humphreys. He went on to compete with Team USA and had the opportunity to compete in 5 World Fly Fishing Championships. He also served as coach for both the U.S. youth team and Fly Fishing Team USA. George is a 2-time U.S. national fly fishing champion and was ranked as high as 5th in the world. This was a fun chat, and we learned about the foundation of George's story and picked his brain on some tips and tricks for advancing our skills. Thanks to our sponsors, and I want to offer a special welcome to our newest sponsor, Bissell Insurance. The Bissell Insurance Agency has been insuring the fishing industry for over 30 years. They currently have over 5,600 clients throughout the U.S. Bissell is the only insurance agency sponsored by the American Fly Fishing Trade Association, also known as AFTA. They provide insurance coverage for fly shops, fishing lodges, guides, outfitters, manufacturers, and pretty much anything in the fishing industry. You can find them at BisselInsuranceAgency.com. Are you in the market for a new fly tying vise or maybe looking at adding a rotary vise to your tying bench? Check out our friends at Norvise. They're at all the fly fishing shows as well as a host of others. You can find details about this fantastic vise and their show schedule as well as their online store at nor-vise.com. Speaking of the shows, you can find all the details to the nationwide fly fishing show tour at flyfishingshow.com. Now let's head to the pod with George.
And we are so excited to have George Daniel on the podcast. George, thanks for being on our show.
No, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you because, you know, I've been reading your books. You've got a couple great books out there. How many books have you written now?
So far, 3.
3 books. Okay, yep. Yeah. I want the listeners to get a better understanding of a bit who you are, maybe past nymphing, because I know you're just an incredible nymph fisherman, did some competition fly fishing in the past, some guiding, sure. Been in the industry for 20 years, but I'd like to kind of learn a bit about George today. How's that sound?
Yeah, sounds good.
So why don't you tell our listeners where you're from?
I'm originally from North Central PA.
Okay.
So I basically grew up in the Pennsylvania-New York border in a small town called Germania. So it's in the middle of nowhere. It's called Potter County, God's country, but it was in the very rural part of North Central PA. So we had, I think, one light in the entire county. So I grew up in this just beautiful little place. It's a great place to grow up as a kid. There was a stream called Germania Branch. It was a tributary to a well-known freestoner called Kettle Creek. But in this stretch, which was basically a stone's throw away from my house, it was the kids-only section.
Okay.
So for up to the age of 14, I had my own little private brook trout fishery all to myself. And then eventually my family and I, we relocated down to the central PA area, but it's the environment kind of created the angler in me.
That's cool. And so what would you say, that was that river, was that your kind of home waters growing up as a kid?
That was kind of my base of operations, but my old man, he would take me all over the place, but I would spend most of my time on that little brook trout fishery.
Do you remember the first time you went fly fishing?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So I had a little 7.5-foot Fenwick fiberglass rod that doubled as my bait rod. But when I was 6 years old, there was just a little pocket right in front of my house. And my old man, I stole a couple Adams, old gray, you know, Adams from his fly box. And I knew how to put a regular hook on from bait fishing. So I stole his fly reel off his rod and then put it on mine. And somehow just chucked it out there and had this little, you know, 8-inch brook trout come up and eat my dry fly. So, yeah, it was a very vivid memory.
There's a lot of thievery going on in that transaction right there. You stole his rod, you stole his reel, you stole his fly.
It was a tough family.
You had to do what you had to do, right?
Exactly.
Tell me about your family now. I know you've got a lovely wife and 2 beautiful kids who, yeah, you guys all love to fly fish together. Tell me about your family.
Yeah, my wife is, we're high school sweethearts. So I knew I had a good one when I had it in high school and kind of held on to it the entire time. But she grew up as a bait angler, and I kind of converted her over into fly fishing, you know, when we were in, you know, basically senior high.
Yep.
But since that time, she has been probably my most coveted fly fishing buddy with me.
And that's awesome.
In the meantime, we have 2 children. We have an 8-year-old boy called Logan and a 10-year-old daughter. Her name's Evangeline. But ever since coming out of the womb, we had those old Kelty backpacks. So we had them on the backpack basically within a couple weeks after birth. So
that's so cool. Yeah. What's your wife's name?
Amity.
Okay, Amity. Okay, great. Where do you guys go? Like, if you could go out together as a family, where would you go?
So, like, right now, what's nice, we moved into an old house. We restored an old farmhouse, but we have a quarter acre farm pond right on our property. It's got all kinds of sunfish, bluegills. So basically, every day after work, we go right to the ponds and we spend, catching little farm, on little tin car rods or like little nymphing rods, just jigging up little streamers. So that's what we do. And then, but we do a bunch of major trips. We do about a 4-week trip out to Montana every year. My brother lives out there.
Wow.
So we use his place as a base of operation. And then we do a bunch of trips down to southern United States, down into like the Holston and so forth. So we do a good bit of traveling, but central PA and that farm pond is kind of our base of operations.
That's cool to have that. Yeah. Come home from work, and now you're a fan of Tinkara?
I am. I use Tinkara a lot, and one of the reasons why I like it, one is it got my kids into fishing. It's very intuitive, as you know. There's not a lot of moving parts, and my kids at age three caught their first trout on a fly because of Tinkara. There's a number of benefits you could talk about, but it's got its limitations. But to get people interested and get them started, with a traditional fly rod, there's a lot of moving parts. But with Tinkara, with that fixed line, it's very intuitive, and it's just one-hand operation, and it just allows people to kind of grasp the concept of casting and line control, relatively easy.
Interesting. Okay, cool. So there you are as that 6-year-old. You stole your dad's gear. Mm-hmm. You caught that beautiful brook trout.
Yeah.
What was next for you? I mean, high school, college. Tell us a little bit about your timeline.
So, I mean, most of my fishing up to that point was kind of self-taught. My old man got me introduced, but he was kind of an impatient old bastard. Was not very, So,
hopefully he doesn't hear this podcast.
Oh, he knows it, yeah.
Oh, he already knows it. Okay.
But when we moved into the state college area, my idol and now become friend, but was Joe Humphrey. So up to that point, I had all his books. But when I moved in that state college area, I got to know Joe just by coincidence, and he kind of took me under his wing. And so starting with age 15, 16, I started getting some formal education from Joe, and then also I would do side jobs, mow grass, paint, yep, fences, got some money. Then I actually hired guides and casting instructors in that area.
Wow.
When I was 16, because it's something kind of, I knew what I wanted to do, at least at that point. So I was really into getting education early on.
And that's, so you get Joe Humphreys. It's, yep, not a bad mentor.
No, it's not bad at all.
And then you invested.
Yep.
You took money out of your pocket. Yep. You were mowing lawns and doing side jobs, and you took, yep, that money and you reinvested it back into your fly fishing.
Yep, exactly.
That's,
yep,
pretty cool. I mean, that's a great lesson for kids and adults of all ages,
Yeah.
Sometimes you need to invest a little bit to learn that knowledge to take your fly fishing or anything to the next level.
Yep.
What is your favorite style of fishing?
I would say streamers is probably my favorite.
Streamers, okay.
Streamers, dry flies, wet flies, and then nymph fishing. But everyone knows me as a nymph fisher. I mean, that's what I do about 80% of the time because, that's what catches fish. But streamers and dry flies, that's what I kind of love to do.
You love feeling that whack.
Love feeling the whack. And with dry fly fishing, I love the stalking. I love the hunting, head hunting.
Yep.
You are like a true predator kind of stalking its prey. And that's what I really like about the dry fly game. And yep, any opportunities I have to have hatches and actually see heads rising, I'll throw the nymph rod down and hunt heads all day.
Now, do you carry two rods?
Sometimes I'll carry two rods. When I'm by myself, usually one rod, and one, yeah, rod I can switch off reels. But when I'm guiding, I carry multiple rods just so, yep, I can have easy access to another tool.
Sure. What is it like raising a fly fishing family?
No, it's like I said, my old man was impatient, and he kind of got me started. But I kind of wanted to do things. That's the whole idea with parenting, as you try to do things a little bit better than your father did, and I'm sure my son will do much better than what I did. But I think the one thing I take pride in is when I started my kid fly fishing, I realized that the worst thing you can do as a parent is think that you can fish at the same time as you're teaching your kid. So for the first 6 to 9 months, I did not fish at all. My entire focus was just getting the kids understanding about the concept of casting, the fishing, and I just spent time working with them. And then, mm-hmm, my wife is the fun one in the family, so she made it fun to the point where, we would bring squirt guns, she would bring snacks, so that we would take a break, but, we would, have squirt gun fights in the middle. So it made it fun, not just with the instructional side of things. So we would spend all day. And what's great now is, when we go out west, and you were talking about the investment, we spend a lot of time with our kids now to the point where we go out west, we can fish from sun up to sundown, and our kids are with us the entire time. Sometimes they're fishing, most of the time they're fishing, sometimes they're throwing rocks,
yep,
but they can be outside all day long and not be worried about being connected to an electronic device or wanting to get back home and watch TV. It's an investment so far that has paid off.
And you guys did it the right way. You did it slow. You didn't force it. Yeah. You kind of let it happen on its own, and now they're fully invested in that,
exactly,
sport with you guys. So
exactly.
That's great information for any young family. We had a couple young men who have a new YouTube, Happy on the Fly, YouTube channel.
Yeah.
You seen those kids?
They're great kids.
Yeah. They were on the podcast yesterday. Colton and Wyatt. Yeah. So they're, you know, to have their dad kind of mentor them and kind of introduce them to filmmaking and record some tying videos for beginners. And it was great to see them all wide-eyed walking around and looking at the different vendors and meeting Tim Flagler. And so it's cool that, you know, you have, that's also like a family. You know, I could sense that real pride that that dad took in teaching his kids about the outdoors. And one of the kids was helping the veterans.
Exactly.
On the stream. Yep. Helping the veterans learn how to catch fish. So
exactly.
That's cool stuff. So what have been some of your best experiences out in the water? I know you mentioned some great ones already with your family. Any great big trips that you've done in the past that you could tell us about?
Yeah, we've done a bunch of trips. You know, when I was on the U.S. team, I mean, I had a bunch of great trips, but we have great fishing here in the States. But what I like about going overseas is just some of the cool experiences, the cultural experiences. Like one of my favorite experiences was actually going and fishing Scotland. And we're fishing Loch Leven, which is home to what they call the brown trout. But what was cool is Loch Leven is like a 20,000-acre, loch. You know, you can't say lakes over there.
You have to say loch.
Loch. They get pretty mad if you call it a lake.
Okay, yeah. They're pretty particular about what you call it.
But on in the middle of this 20,000-acre loch is this island, and there's this castle. And this was one of the castles that the Scots held the Queen of England captive during one of the wars. And there's just incredible history. And you know, you go to parts of the Italian Alps and the Dolomites, and you know, our guide was basically saying that, you know, this is where the Germans were coming over in the border.
Wow.
So, you know, I like going overseas. The fishing is really good, but some of my favorite experiences was from the cultural standpoint.
Yeah.
And I would say probably one of my best experiences was actually fishing with my wife on the North Island in New Zealand. We were just doing a small little kind of a hike back into the mountains, and we actually had some wild horses that would come out and just walk down the river while we were fishing.
Wild horses.
That's what they said. They said there were wild horses.
That's incredible.
And it was just a great experience. And if you watch any of the Lord of the Rings, but you have that backdrop, and obviously the fishing was nice, but it was just a vivid picture that will always stick in my mind.
Yeah, so you kind of love that entire circle, that whole picture.
I do. I mean, I like fishing, but at least as I'm getting older, I guess a little bit wiser, hopefully. I mean, I like the whole picture. I really do.
The experience.
And that's great. Fishing is great, but also it's the people and the whole atmosphere that kind of connects all of them together.
The journey. I have to throw that word in there one time in the podcast. Every podcast, I have to find the spot to put the word journey in.
So that's cool.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit of technical? We got to give our listeners a little bit of your knowledge from a technical standpoint.
Or lack of. I'd be happy to.
Some of the questions, and I was kind of pinging some of these questions. All right, I'm interviewing George Daniel tomorrow. So give me some questions. So I go to Josh Miller, I go to my friends at Watermaster, I say, all right, what do you think I should ask? So I've got a kind of a selection.
Sure.
This isn't any like a road, or we're not starting from the beginning to the end. This is kind of like a catch-all.
Yeah.
What would you say for weight, getting the fly down? Is it more, obviously everything that I'm going to ask you is going to be dependent upon the situation.
Sure.
Given. Yeah. But weighted nymphs or split shot is your preference?
Well, definitely preference is just weighted flies. Use nothing but the weight of the fly. Less tangles, a little more direct contact. So I would say I do that probably 70% of the time. But, you know, when you're on the Madison River, you're on the $3 bridge area, and you've got a torrent of water coming down, and you're trying to fish two little shop backs or little serendipities or little, you know, shop flashback nymphs, there's only so much weight you can put into smaller flies. And that's where, in some situations, like a drop shot rig with supplemental weight, that's where you're going to get down. But, you know, shot tangles, and it's a hassle to deal with. So it's just a necessary evil. But I would say weighted flies most of the time.
Interesting. Okay, that's so cool. So your preference would be to use a weighted fly, but if the fly that you need to use isn't weighted, that's when you have to go to your split shot.
Yeah, usually. And,
that's cool. That's a great way to look at that.
And the thing is, I mean, if you look at competition fishing, and I'm not bashing anyone that does the comp stuff, but you hear Euro. And the problem is that in European competitions, you're not allowed to use split shot. So what happens is if they need them to get down slower, deeper, they are forced to use what they refer to as an anchor fly, a little heavier fly. And it gets to a point where it's more of a sacrificial fly, where if the fly is too big, you're not going to catch many fish on it, but it's just basically dead weight. And it's got a hook point, so if it's heavy enough and it's dragging along the bottom, you're going to be occasionally, or quite often, losing that fly.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets to the point where if I'm not finding myself going to catch fish on a big fly, I'm basically going to be using two small, unweighted flies and then just using weight.
Mm-hmm.
That's my point. So
your point would would be that weight then.
That weight, yep. Usually.
So just for the general listener here, maybe not the comp guy, but just somebody who wanted to set up a two-fly nymph rig, what would be like a leader, tippet, two-fly nymph rig look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm using a lot of the mono stuff, like mono rig.
Okay.
So, you know, you got to watch where you're going because in some states, some waters, it's you need technically to have fly line. But for the most part, we're just using monofilament. And, you know, my setup, the stuff I like to use with my mono rig, it's called the OPST. It's their Lazar line. So it's a running line that they use for the Skagit heads for the, you know, the OPST. But that running line, that mono, is just, of all the monofilaments, it's the slickest, it's got the least amount of memory, and it's very easy to handle with your line hand, because when you're casting, you're not only just, you know, holding with the rod, but you're actually using your line hand to retrieve the line. And monofilament that has a tendency of coiling and have a memory, it's just difficult and challenging. So that OPST is just phenomenal line to kind of just allow you to actually treat it like a fly line, but have the sensitivity as mono. So I'll just have a whole spool of that. So there's no fly line. It's just a whole spool of OPST. And the leaders I'm using is pretty simple. I'll have a 25-pound test, a whole spool of that. And then I run maybe about 4 feet of 12-pound white opaque mono from Cortland, kind of as my base leader. And then I have a two and a half foot section of cider material, colored monofilament to a tipper ring. That's it. And then your tippet, depending on the speed and depth of the water. But it's a very simple formula.
I like that. I'm going to probably listen to this section of the podcast over 17 times to get it all. But the beautiful part is it's now recorded.
Yep.
So that's cool. It's not what I anticipated you saying.
Keep it simple. Keep it really simple.
Tie off the bend of the hook or the eye of the hook?
Yeah, 90% of the time I'm tying off a tag end.
A tag. So neither the bend or the eye. You're using a tag.
Yeah, you know, still I'm tying off a tag. It's just the tendency, I find myself foul hooking way too many fish. I think sometimes that, you know, if you're tying off the bend, definitely I think that knot almost becomes like a weed guard essentially, and kind of prevents the fish from actually eating that, and you end up flossing or sticking the fish in the top of the head with a trailing fly. But if I was going to do like a fly to fly attachment, definitely off the eye. But most of the time I like the droppers. I really do.
So
a dry dropper rig, I mean, everything's tied off of droppers.
So triple surgeon with a tag?
Usually a triple surgeon's, yep.
Triple surgeon, leave that tag and then tie off?
The bottom tag, usually.
The bottom, and that would be your second fly.
Yep.
So that's a long tag.
Yeah.
It depends on how long you need.
Depending on how long you need, yeah.
Yeah. All right. I'm learning here.
Yeah.
Thank you, George.
No.
What type of indicator? So I'm not sure how much indicator.
I use a lot of indicators.
Okay. What type of indicator do you prefer? Like a thinking bob, or what is your preference?
It really, as you're saying, it depends on the situation. You know, if you look at the surface area of a thema bobber, a couple things. Thema bobbers are hard plastic shells, so if you are casting, if you have a lot of wind, that weight of that wall helps cast against the wind. And then two, if you're trying to suspend a lot of weight, that surface area allows you to basically put a lot of weight underneath it. But most of where I'm fishing in central PA, we're fishing lightweight rigs, small flies. So I would probably say the two indicators I use the most are actually those tiny little pinch-on indicators and then the New Zealand wool indicator. And I would say the New Zealand wool indicator is by far my favorite. It's just, for most people, it's a little wind resistant, but from the ability to actually adjust the depths and have the strike detection, the wool indicator is amazing, because if you look at the base, if you can put a picture or see the picture, there's a wedge. So instead of having a rounded flat area, there is basically this little wedge with this tuft of hair sticking out. And what's cool is it doesn't take much friction for a fish to hit that fly to basically pull that fly, that indicator under. And when the fish strikes, there's no guesswork. It's no hesitation. Right. It just shoots under. That's what I like. It's basically a dummy-proof version to understand when the strike occurs.
How much weight of a fly or a split can you put under New Zealand? Because I've used it some, and if I'm using lighter flies, then I'm usually okay. But as I get a heavier setup, I can tend to go under too early.
I mean, you can only do so much. I mean, you could put it on a weight scale, but essentially what I'm doing is you can use, with a New Zealand wool, you could probably put two size B shots at the most.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, what I'm doing with the New Zealand wool is I'm fishing it on five and most of the time 6X tippet.
Yep.
And because of the small diameter tippet, it allows me to actually fish less weight. Because of the smaller tippet, my rig actually drops a lot faster.
Okay. I see what you're saying. Would you gink it up?
Yeah, so there's always I always do a pre-treatment. I'll do a couple of those pre-treated before I take them out. And then not so much to gink. I actually, for the wool, I actually use a gel or a paste, like a Loon Payot paste or any sort of Cortland Dab, the old stuff. But I kind of dab that up as a pre-treatment, and then whenever I need to, I can use the brush.
Okay.
You know, desk it.
Well, sounds good. That is great information right there. Here's another one. Mm-hmm. on the book, the dynamic nymphing, mm-hmm. you talk about the Czech style, the Polish style, sure. Even on the cover, the French, the UK, the US. Can you elaborate or differentiate between like Czech and Polish?
Yeah, you can. I mean, when I wrote the book in 2011, European nymphing was relatively a newer term. And the thing about it was there were some differences. I mean, but they're just minor slights, basically. It's not a big deal. Anymore today, everyone just calls it like contact nymphing.
Contact.
But basically, it's like short line with the Czech and the Polish, very short line versus where the Spanish and the French, they were using really long leaders with light tippets further out.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's basically what you call it is adjusting to the conditions. That's all we're doing. You're just tight lining, but you're just adjusting, whether you're fishing broken pocket water close by or you're making long casts and skinny flats.
Right.
That's all you're doing.
Yeah, because I have a good friend, Gary Hankies, that runs the Alberta Fly Fishing community on Facebook, and he's on Team Canada or has done some stuff with Team Canada. I love hearing him talk about, okay, the Spanish is over here, or the Poles, or the Czechs, or the, you know, French, because, you know, they all have their own little stylization of the way they do things. And, you know, he talks about the competition in the worlds.
Yeah.
And, you know, oh, this country's been great at so long, and all of a sudden now this country's been great. And so it's interesting to hear about all that stuff, kind of like the Olympics of fly fishing.
It is. Yeah. No, it was, you know, you can create, you can easily create a border war. I mean, when it comes to, like, when you talk about Czech and Polish. I mean, I'm Polish. I'm about 60% Polish, but I have a friend, Vladi. He was a former world champion. He was one of our coaches for the first couple of years I was competing, but he gets really pissed when you hear the word Czech. I mean, when he got one of my books when he was over in Europe, and he saw the word Czech on my book, and he didn't speak to me for 6 months. And we're both Polish.
It's that serious.
It's, depending on who you talk to, they're very proud of their techniques.
So, because it was called maybe Czech nymphing, when actually I heard, I guess maybe the Poles were the one who invented it.
Poles were one of the first to actually kind of introduce it. The Czechs kind of took it, refined it, and they started winning competitions. And they were the ones that kind of popularized it, from what I've been told.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, there's still a little tension,
a little warfare there. That's interesting. And, you know, that's the kind of the interesting part about it, too. But there's so many personalities, and like the, you mentioned these names, and there's these huge names in that whole world.
Yep.
And so it's interesting. It's just interesting to me. I mean, I have no interest in pursuing that. I'm more of a traveler, like you say, the culture. That's what I love about the fishing. Yeah. But I do want to get better at this technique.
I mean, it's basically the same thing. I mean, I look at it the same way. Like when Steve Jobs and Apple came out with the iPod, you know, basically like whatever it was, 1,000 songs in your pocket.
Yeah.
They didn't reinvent music, but they reinvented the way we listen to music.
That's
the same
cool.
thing with European nymphing. European nymphing is not reinventing nymphing. It's just basically rethinking some of the tools in your approaches to nymphing. And the tools with the nymphing rods and the siders just make your job a lot easier. And that's all it is. Just enhancement of the old techniques.
Super fun. Super fun. What are your roles here, George, at the fly fishing shows?
Sure, at the shows, they have me as kind of like an educator. So I do some casting demonstrations, a couple seminars, some tying clinics as well. So just kind of going around and actually just acting as an educator and trying to put on some clinics and not screw people up too bad, that's all.
Teach. And you're like the only one I see with your bare feet in the pond. Everyone else fishes from the dry. You actually get into the casting pond.
It's just engage. I don't know. I like to engage a little bit. So, yeah.
I was told to ask you, why you always wearing flip-flops?
Well, there's a couple. Well, long story short, I get stupid questions. I'm in Boston, Massachusetts, and people are like, why, it's freezing outside. But no, long story short, my old man was kind of a tough, hard ass on me. So we would
Sounds
hunt.
Like
so I ended up getting, I almost like got like frostbite. So I don't have many nerves in my feet. And so I don't get cold. I get cold in my hands and my, cold in my head and my hands, but my feet really don't get cold. And if you ever listened or read the book Born to Run by Chris McDougall, talks about like the whole barefoot movement and how these tribes are. So basically, it kind of, my feet for years ached, wearing like these super cushioned shoes and whatnot. And I read that book and started reading up on proprioception and found out that my feet are so much more comfortable when I'm wearing sandals. Whenever I wear shoes, my feet cramp up. So I don't get cold, my feet don't get cold, and it's more comfortable.
That's awesome. Well, that's a good answer. I'm going to tell the person who told me that. There, your answer. How can somebody improve their casting? Because I see you do a lot of great casting demonstrations. Yeah. I know you probably have to come to a demonstration or read up a book. But what are some techniques or what are some activities that somebody can do to improve their casting?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the first thing to do is find a qualified instructor in your area. But, you know, some of the great things that, like, Joe would teach me was essentially just limiting arm movement, because most of the time with trout fishing, you don't need to make these long wave emotions. I mean, short casting strokes, I mean, short stream fishing, it doesn't require a lot of power. So doing simple things like just putting your elbow on your knee, and just that eliminates the whole wanting to throw the javelin effect. So just keep the elbow locked in and just basically just come back and just pretend like you're basically squeezing a screen door, coming back and squeeze. That's it. And what he'll talk about is just pretend like you have a two-sided hammer. You're going to tap a nail. You're going to put a wall or a picture on the wall behind you in front of you. You're going to tap the nail behind you, tap the nail in front of you. I mean, that's it.
Oh, that's cool.
But just a short little cast stroke. And that just kind of gets you ingrained that muscle. And then eventually you can use a longer stroke. But just work on that, because that's 90% of what I do from a trout fishing standpoint.
Just kind of shrink everything down a little bit.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Why don't, before we close, George, why don't you tell our listeners and our viewers a little bit about some of your interests outside of fly fishing?
I mean, I'm a hack photographer, love photography. My brother is he lives in West Yellowstone, but he's a legitimate, I mean, he's a guide, fly fishing guide, snowmobile instructor, but he's a professional photographer. And just spending time out there with him and just seeing the images, and that's the thing I love about still photography, because the people that can do it right, I mean, they just capture like the moment. So for the last probably 5 or 6 years, I'm a hack photographer, but I kind of like photography.
That's cool.
Practice a little bit, but lots of hiking. We do piles of hiking with the kids. And then fly fishing is about 99% of it.
That's awesome. Hiking local, or do you more when you travel?
Both. Yep. Both. We do a lot of hikes local, close by. In fact, when our kids, you could tell, like when it got cold outside and the kids were not allowed to go outside for recess for school, they come back just all jazzed up and just too much energy.
Yeah.
So I would, you know, sometimes I would do night marches with them, even in February back home, just run them around for about 2 miles, tire them out. So we like to hike.
So you get a little of your dad in you, I think.
Exactly.
It always carries forward. No matter what you do, it still
comes. Without a doubt, yep.
Well, that's cool. Well, it's been great to get to know you. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your schedule? What's on your plan for this year?
So I got done doing all those fly fishing shows, getting ready to get in the guide season. I basically do like 100 days in a row, knock them out, and then I take off most of the summer with my family. We do a big 6-7 week road trip out west.
Very cool.
And then I'll do some work out there, but then I come back, basically guide for about 2 months straight. And then take off for the holidays.
Do you have a website? Yeah, you do have a website.
I do. It's called Living on the Fly, but it's LIVIN on the fly. And I also have a blog. I do.
Okay.
2 or 3 posts a month. Keep it simple and short.
Yeah, and the blog is also on Living on the Fly.
It is, yep.
So livingonthefly.com, LIVIN, onthefly.com. Well, it's so cool. Thank you so much, George, for being on the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate it.
I've had a ton of fun, learned a lot, so hopefully maybe we can have you again.
That would be great. Love to come back.
Thanks, George.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.